This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. As it's been reported, the Texas hamlet of Sutherland Springs, east of San Antonio, about 40 miles, is dealing with the worst mass shooting in Texas history. A gunman attacked the Baptist church there on Sunday morning, and at least 26 people are dead. The scene is a horrible flashback to the Colleen Lubies shooting in 1991 that left 24 people dead. I was in Sutherland Springs yesterday covering the story. I saw how the community was stunned by this senseless gun violence. I also attended last night's prayer vigil.
May the Lord give us peace.
Yes. Thank you.
Comfort.
Hours after the prayers of Sutherland Springs First Baptist Church were cut off by gunfire, members of the community gathered by candlelight. They wanted to complete those interrupted prayers and find strength and answers in their faith.
Father God, we ask that you heal our broken hearts.
Yes.
The vigil was held across the two-lane Highway 87 from the church that is now an active crime scene. Sutherland Springs is an unincorporated town of 643 people. It's a place where everyone knows one another. Alda Dalton lives down the street from the church. It was the arrival of the helicopter ambulances that alerted her that something terrible had happened. She soon found out that one of her good friends was killed.
Unfortunately, she had two young children, and now they don't have a mom.
She came to the vigil to offer her prayers.
To celebrate the lives that went home forever today, and to hope and pray for the ones that are still in surgery. I still have loved ones in surgery.
Like many attending the vigil, Joyce Emily stood holding a candle with tears streaming down her cheeks. She said she was familiar with the church and its members.
Actually, we used to go to this church till God led us in a different direction. So,
what was that church like?
It was very family-oriented, and when you walked in, you knew you were loved.
Pastor Stephen Curry of the nearby Lavernia United Methodist Church told the crowd not to let the actions of this one man with a gun change who they are.
Who are we going to be tomorrow? We are going to be the people of Texas.
Amen.
The people of Sutherland Springs.
Amen.
The people of First Baptist Church.
Amen.
We are going to be God's people.
Yes.
We are going to be servants of the King.
Amen.
And we are going to show compassion where compassion needs to be shown. We will mourn the dead. We will lift up the families who are hurting. We will offer them what we can.
But I asked Curry if after today's shooting, if he's going to be making changes to the security at his own church.
We can't make our churches fortresses. They're supposed to be open for people to come in and worship. We have people in our church that we, in our congregation, we do have officers who worship in our congregation. And we will listen to their advice and their instruction as to how they feel we can best deal with this as far as safety. But we're, the doors of the church are to be open as a place of prayer for all people.
Despite the pleas to the community not to be darkened by the actions of this killer, it's hard to imagine that that is possible. One resident told me that it was this remote, rural location that had helped them feel safe from this national plague of senseless violence. But now they understand that in today's America, these tragic mass shootings can happen anywhere. In Sutherland Springs, Texas, David Martin Davies, Texas Public Radio News. And there are new developments in the story of the church shooting. We're joined by Texas Public Radio's Joy Palacios, who is at the scene. Joy, what's the latest?
Officials with the Department of Public Safety, the FBI, and the ATF wrapped up a press conference where they say that they believe this shooting was the result of a domestic dispute. You know, they, as we heard Becky Fogel say a little while ago, that this was not racially or religiously motivated, but that the shooter, 26-year-old Devin Patrick Kelly, had been sending threatening text messages to his mother-in-law. What those text messages said, what they were about, officials didn't want to say, but that they believe that that was the could have been the reason for the shooting.
So we know that Devin Patrick Kelly was court-martialed, and he was given a dishonorable discharge from the Air Force. The court-martial was in connection to family violence against his wife and his child. I read that he was also confined for a year after that. So this apparently was a very serious conviction of him against in the Code of Military Justice. So I guess there are indications that Devin Patrick Kelly may have blamed his mother-in-law for the situation.
Well, I don't know if we could say that just yet. The officials here didn't want to go into details of what that domestic situation was. They would only just say that he had been in contact via text message with the mother-in-law.
Also, we are finding out that that Kelly, when he was fleeing the scene and he was being pursued, he was able to make a cell phone call to his father. Is that right?
That is correct. They only said that he notified his father. So whether it was text or a cell phone call, we're not sure. But he did try to make a call or contact his father. Whether or not that went through, we're not sure. Or if it did, we're not sure what was said.
Where is this investigation going, Joey? If the assailant is dead and there's little doubt that he is the guy, and are they looking to see if he had any associates and help?
Well, that's what they're working on now. They're doing interviews with various people, talking to folks here in the community, talking to folks who may have known Kelly. There is video of inside the church. First Baptist Church would regularly broadcast or put up a video later about their church service. They recorded the service yesterday as well. So officials can confirm that there is video, but that video probably won't be released, and it's unclear what is seen on there.
You were part of a press conference with the Wilson County Sheriff Joe Tackett earlier today, and he was still, you could see that he was grieving.
He is very much in grief right now. He has said that he was very close to a family that was killed in the shooting. He didn't want to name who they are, but he said that they were close personal friends of his. I have been able to talk to at least one other person here. So we are getting a picture of who some of these victims are. A gentleman by the name of Jim Crossley told me that his friend Joanne Ward was inside the church with her three children. Ward and her two daughters were killed. Her son, from what I understand, from what Mr. Crossley told me, her son is still in a very serious condition at a San Antonio hospital right now, and that's the only information that he had. And the people in this town are torn. They're hurting. I have seen people hugging. I have seen people trying to comfort one another. A woman who works at the convenience store across the street, she was talking to a friend and trying to, she said it's basically, you know, they have to do check everybody that comes in because they don't know who survived, who did not.
Joey, okay, we will talk to you back. We will be at the end of the hour talking more about the latest developments in Sutherland Springs. The Source continues after this break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the mass shooting at the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs. And you're invited to call in 210-614-8980. Tell us your reaction. We're also going to be talking about some of the recent shakeups in local politics. We're joined by Scott Braddock. He is the editor of The Quorum Report, co-host of the Texas Take podcast. Scott, welcome to The Source.
Dave, good to talk to you.
Okay, and so Scott Braddock, we're seeing some reaction from our local politicians about the shooting that we have in the Sutherland Springs. Here's a soundbite from Governor Greg Abbott.
More unknowns than there are knowns. Like, let me share with you this one fact that I am told by the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, and that is that Devin Kelly sought to get a license to carry a gun in the state of Texas, but the state of Texas denied him the ability to get a gun. So how was it that he was able to get a gun? By all the facts that we seem to know, he was not supposed to have access to a gun. So how did this happen? But Chris, that is just one of the unknowns out there. We are in search of answers to these questions, and the answers will be coming to light here in the coming days. And before we can solve the problem, we need to know the answers to all these multitude of questions.
And that was Governor Greg Abbott speaking on CNN this morning. So, Scott Braddock, I'm hearing a little bit of a change in Governor Abbott's tone, that he may be almost open to a discussion about some sort of a gun measure.
Well, it sounds to me like he's trying to sidestep the question of whether there should be any more gun measures. You know, in Texas, as you know, Dave, it's not really a fine line that politicians who are Republicans have to walk. They have to walk the hard line, right? They have to be absolutely opposed to new gun measures. It sounds like from the interview that you played some audio from on CNN, and I also saw him on CBS News this morning, talking about the idea that we ought to enforce the laws that we have and ensure that if there are background checks, that there aren't loopholes in those. So closing some of those loopholes, definitely something that is something that Republicans might be open to. But, you know, even after the massacre in Las Vegas and then the shooting in South Texas, you know, just 30 miles east of San Antonio, we don't even see action on those bump stocks, what was used in Las Vegas. And we don't see a lot of Republican politicians talking about reining in guns. In fact, another one of our politicians here in Texas, a statewide politician, the Attorney General Ken Paxton, said during an interview yesterday on Fox News that the answer is more guns, not less. He said that more people ought to be carrying weapons in churches. If we're going to be able to take down the bad guys, we need more good guys with guns. That continues to seem to be the message from Republicans statewide in this state.
The one question might be is how long that line will continue to work for them. I was at the scene, and I could tell you that I don't see how if every person in that church had been armed, if they would have made much of a difference against this individual who showed up in tactical armor with a weapon that was rigged to, you know, was just, I know there's no such thing as an assault rifle. You hear that all the time from the gun folks, but this was, you know, an assault rifle, and he was firing out in from outside into the church. There's no way anyone can return fire at that time. And then after then, he went inside and began to finish people off. So this was a military type assault, an attack on this church with these people. There was as Sheriff Tackett said earlier, there was no place to run. They could not defend themselves.
It's a great point. You know, in this state, the election of consequence is the Republican primary. If you look at the 2014 election, where you had $40 million spent on behalf of the Democratic candidate for governor and therefore the Democratic slate in 2014, the last non-presidential election, the last time statewides were up for re-election, including Governor Abbott and when Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Ken Paxton were elected. You know, there were $40 million spent for Democrats, and they came in 21 points behind the Republicans. It's simply a function of the fact that in the Republican primary, which becomes the election of consequence when that is the reality, you have those who will say first that the Attorney General is right in this case. The voters in those elections agree with him when they say that more people with guns equals a safer Texas.
Our number to call in, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. They say that gun supporters tend to be single-issue voters. It doesn't matter what else a politician has on their record and what else they support. They are going to solely look at this one issue. Where are they on the absolutism of the Second Amendment? And so how big of a force is the single-issue voter in Texas when it comes to guns, Scott Braddock?
You know, when you look at the polling on this, the single-issue voters in the Republican primary tend to worry about a few things. You know, they fall into different categories, but the top issues are immigration and border security. They're also education, health care, and getting rid of Obamacare is what Republican primary voters would like to see. Guns are always, you know, in the top 10 list.
And pro-life. So it's,
Pro-life, absolutely. But, you know, pro-life is one of the issues. You know, obviously, they would say pro-life, but the other side would say abortion rights. But interestingly, abortion rights are further down on the list when you look at the priorities of those folks. And when you travel this state, as you have and as I have, covering the issues in this, you know, all across this state from north to south to east to west, when you go to Republican events, like say you go to, I was at the Hunt County Republican club last year where they were asking questions. And what's interesting is when you listen to the questions that the crowd asks instead of as the journalist think about the questions that you're asking, when you listen to what the crowd asks about, it's immigration and border security. It's it is gun issues and whether or not the Second Amendment rights are going to be defended and those sorts of things. And abortion rights is something they almost never ask about. It's something that they will weigh in on strongly if you ask them. But if you give them the opportunity to start the conversation, it's usually about border security.
But when we're talking about gun rights in Texas, we really haven't had a shooting like this in Texas since the 1991 Luby's shooting in Killeen. Do you think that would make much of a difference? Texas hasn't had one of these at this magnitude.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, when you look at the shooting in Las Vegas, it was the first shooting from an elevated position since the gunman Charles Whitman took to the top of the UT Tower, where I'm talking to you from on the University of Texas campus. And when these things unfold, there's always a conversation that is immediately tried to be stifled by some folks who say that you shouldn't be talking about gun policy when there has been a shooting like this. And look at the President of the United States and his comments today, as you know, speaking from Tokyo about the shooting at Sutherland Springs. He said, President Trump said, that this is a mental health issue. You've had a little bit of movement in Congress where we have our senior senator, John Cornyn, talk about the need to deal with mental health, and he hasn't come out in favor of gun restrictions, but dealing with mental health as it relates to firearms. It's something where if people aren't willing to look at it in a holistic sense, that is, you know, dealing with the mental health issues, dealing with, you know, what kind of restrictions ought to be in place for firearms, et cetera, then it doesn't seem that this is going to get any better.
So the possible motive that we're hearing now from this mass shooting is that there was a domestic problem with the family, that the shooter, Devin Patrick Kelly, went to that church because that's the church that his mother-in-law attended, although she was not there that day. Does that make a difference in how this plays out in the narrative and in the political arena, that this was not terrorism, this was not racially motivated, this was just a domestic abuse? Domestic scene.
Isn't it interesting that when you have someone who is accused of domestic terrorism, like in New York, where the gentleman was killing people with a rental truck and then apparently was using some less than powerful firearms when he got out of the truck. But when that happens and the motivation is said to be perhaps domestic terrorism and the person is from a foreign country, then the president is immediately ready to prescribe a solution for that and say that we should get rid of the diversity lottery for immigration. But when it's a domestic situation that may be between some people who are in a family and a gun is used, a powerful weapon, we should add, as you've covered here in your news coverage, powerful weapons used in this attack in South Texas, the immediate reaction from Republican politicians is that nothing should be changed, nothing should be done. If you think about the terrorist attacks of 9/11, it's not as if people had this fatalistic attitude like there's nothing we can do about it, right? Before 9/11, you had one experience going through the airport, and now you have a very different experience because they decided there were lots of things we could do about that when it came to airport security. I don't see a lot of movement on this going forward. And if you think about the fact that when President Obama was in office and you had more mass shootings during his tenure in office than you had had in U.S. history up to that point, and he was a Democrat in the White House, saying we needed to have more restrictions on guns. It still didn't happen then. It's hard to imagine it happening now.
But politicians, they're going to ride this train as long as they can. If they're not concerned that there's going to be a backlash against them for their continued blind support for the NRA and the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. until something happens and you're wondering if this is the event that could change attitudes broadly across Texas.
You know, it's not just, and I guess we should say it this way, it's not just that there won't be blowback, it's that they will be rewarded for standing with the folks who say that there should be more guns in public places. Look at what happened in the last two legislative sessions in Austin, where you had in 2015 open carry of firearms approved by the Texas legislature, even when you had members of the legislature who had been physically threatened by people who were supporting that policy. You might remember that that was when they put panic buttons in the offices of some lawmakers who had been threatened by people who wanted to see open carry passed. You had open carry activists go into a Democratic lawmaker's office and refuse to leave when he was trying to kick them out, and that lawmaker felt threatened. You had members of both parties wearing buttons with that lawmaker's name, Poncho Navarro's, who's from West Texas, from the Alpine area. Lawmakers of both parties wearing buttons, wearing stickers on their suit jackets that said, "I am Poncho," to show solidarity, yet that bill still passed. And by the way, I should note that even after all that, as that was playing out in the lieutenant governor's office, in Dan Patrick's office, those same activists were welcomed with cookies and lemonade.
And so this is because I was at the scene. Maybe I see things in a different color than sure. I had before. Mm-hmm. And when you see that small Texas town and those people deeply wounded by, deeply hurting from the shooting, you wonder, are these attitudes sustainable? Will there come a time when people will say we have to make some adjustments?
I think that the best argument that those who want to make some progress on this, the best argument they have is what Governor Abbott alluded to in the audio soundbite that you played, which is maybe closing some of these loopholes. As I understand it, this guy, this shooter, had checked some boxes on his forms, and they were just things that he or either left them unchecked or checked some boxes that just turned out to not be true. And it was never caught, and he was able to purchase these weapons anyway. It seems like closing those loopholes is probably the best bet for right now, but in a state like Texas, I don't think that, and by the way, being on the scene certainly affects the way we would view these things, and listening to the heartbreaking stories that are coming out of this small community. I grew up in a small town in Texas, probably about the same size, down in Louise, Texas, near Victoria. The fact is that even those folks, a few weeks from now, will probably be saying that they'd rather be packing at church than not packing at church.
Yeah, but talking about closing loopholes, that's really a federal government position to take. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so with Greg Abbott calling for that, he's basically pivoting and not taking that responsibility.
Absolutely. And that's the same way that he and other lawmakers or other top leaders in this state, including top lawmakers, that's the way they talk about immigration as well. They'll say that we should have more border security here, and they're willing to spend $800 million of your tax dollars every 2 years to secure the Texas-Mexico border. But when you press them about what ought to be done with the people who are already here in undocumented status, they'll say, well, that's a federal issue. They ought to deal with that.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll come back again with Scott Braddock, and we'll be talking about some shakeups in Texas political scene, some major players deciding not to run for re-election. Also, tomorrow there is an election for some state propositions, constitutional amendments that many people know nothing about. So we're going to find out why these aren't a bigger thing than they actually are. If you've got a question or comment, call in. The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Tomorrow, Texas will vote on 7 constitutional amendments. It's an election day, but don't expect a stampede at the polls. There are some hyper-local races across the state, but nothing as hyped up as last year's presidential election. So what is up with these propositions? We're joined by Scott Braddock here. He's with the Quorum Report and the Texas Take podcast. Also, we have Grace Chamaine. She is a board member for the League of Women Voters in Texas. But first, before we get to that, real quickly, Scott, let me ask you, get your take on the resignation, not the resignation, but the announcement that Joe Strauss, Speaker, mm-hmm. will not be seeking re-election to the House. Did you see that coming?
Well, it's not. I don't know that I saw it coming. And in fact, I think only probably about four people, including his wife and himself, knew that that was going to happen when it did happen. Although I don't think you can say that it's a great surprise. He's going to be at the end of a decade of doing this when this term is over, and running the Texas House of Representatives, and you know, the balancing act that is, and the fact that you are constantly under attack by certain folks in your own party who say that you're not conservative enough. It's kind of like the political equivalent of having your hand in a meat grinder every day and have that be your existence. That's about how pleasant it would be. Can't say I'm surprised that he's choosing to retire. It has kicked off a lot of interesting discussion about who will succeed him in the speaker's chair, and frankly, who's going to run for his seat in San Antonio. You probably know more about that than I do. But as far as who's going to succeed him as speaker, I know it's frustrating, but it's just way too soon to know that. If you think about the fact that in 2009, when he was elected speaker, no one would have guessed. No one on the House floor, none of the other 149 members would have pointed at Joe Strauss and said, I bet that guy's going to be the next speaker. And the reason is he was a sophomore lawmaker. He'd never even chaired a committee, had never passed any significant legislation. He's from a longtime Republican family and somebody who's very well thought of in Republican circles, but was not accomplished in any way as a lawmaker at that point. And so, you know, as far as who's going to be the next speaker, it would be a fool's errand to try to figure that out right now. There are a couple of people who are already running, though. You have John Zerwas, who is from the Houston area, a Republican who is a physician and is well-respected by Republicans and Democrats. He's also someone who, like Phil King from Weatherford, who's also a Republican who was announced for speaker. He's also somebody who has kind of put himself out in the middle of the road to be hit by a Mack truck, because now both of them are having to answer questions about what they would do as speaker, how it would be different under their leadership, and we haven't even gotten through the Republican primary yet. And Dave, as I know that you know and your listeners know, there's already a move within the Republican caucus to try to change the way in which the speaker is elected. You have Republicans who would like to see Republicans only select their candidate for speaker and exclude the Democrats from that. The way that the speaker is elected right now, of course, is that all 149 other members vote on that, vote on who the speaker is going to be. And that's Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, moderates, liberals, everybody. And in that way, the Speaker of the House is probably of the big three leaders in this state, the governor, lieutenant governor, and speaker. Speaker is probably most representative of the entire state because he has to represent all those different constituencies. But there is a group called the Freedom Caucus within the Republican caucus. It's about 12 members who say that they're the most conservative members. These are some of the lawmakers who were pushing the hardest for things like the bathroom bill, which failed, and the sanctuary cities ban, which did pass at the behest of Governor Abbott. That small group of lawmakers, the Freedom Caucus, they've forced the conversation within their caucus about who or about how the speaker should be chosen. But that moves us toward the way they do it in Washington, which, of course, is so successful there. They don't have any dysfunction in Washington, do they, Dave? And if you look at the fact that even though they do it that way in Washington, that the Republicans pick their speaker when they're in the majority, or the Democrats pick the speaker when they're in the majority. You could never envision Republicans voting for Nancy Pelosi for speaker, could you? You have to think about this, though. These Freedom Caucus guys have forced the conversation, but there's no right math that I can do or that anybody can do that makes one of them the next Speaker of the House.
Because so we'll have to see how that plays out.
Yes, that small group is forcing a conversation right that probably doesn't help them that much.
Also, real quickly, we didn't see Lamar Smith, and he's not going to seek re-election as his congressional mm-hmm. seat, a seat that covers part of San Antonio, part of Austin, and a lot of the Hill Country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have a sort of a small army of Democrats who have lined up to run, who had lined up to run against him. It doesn't look like they have any of them has much of a shot of winning that seat, and just simply because of the way that that district is drawn to advantage whoever the Republican is. And Smith himself has said he's confident a Republican will be in that spot. That's probably right, but we'll see what the Trump effect really is in some of these elections next year. And as far as which Republicans are going to maybe throw their hat in the ring, this is the fun part because we haven't even gotten to the filing period yet, which runs from November 11th to December 11th for that one-month period. And at that point, we'll see the rubber meet the road and see which candidates actually throw their hat in the ring and which ones do not.
Okay, so let's bring the League of Women Voters board member Grace Chamain into our conversation. And as we talk about these propositions that are before Texas voters, and so there are seven of them. And Grace, I'm going to ask you if you got a favorite.
That is a hard one. I tell you which one is most complicated. Okay. And that is the home equity loan, Proposition 2.
Prop 2.
But I can tell you, I'm having a good time kind of with these, the ones that are about raffles. You know, raffles are kind of fun, so we should talk about the two that have to do with raffles.
Raffles and money. That's what's on the table. Yeah, so Proposition
Absolutely.
2 has a lot of complicated factors into it, and it does impact the real estate economy. And it's been called a wolf in sheep's clothing by some people who are opposed to it, saying that it makes it sound like it's going to make getting a home equity loan more cheaper and more cheap. But actually, it could do just the opposite. There's a lot of moving parts to this. So, Grace,
six different items that is really changing with the financing rules, and it has me. It's very interesting.
Yeah. So why do we have to go through a constitutional amendment for this to change home equity lending laws in the state of Texas?
My understanding is that the Constitution covers home loans and home financing. And so when you want to change the way it's done, you have to have a constitutional amendment.
Right. We know that the way that the state constitution was drafted, they put in some protections for homesteads, the homestead mm-hmm. protection. And that is something that used to be sacred in Texas. But little by little, we've been chipping away at that. And so now we've reached a point where the 1876 Constitution looks very different in this regard in this Section 50. And this is what the voters want, Grace?
Is this what the voters want? Well, if the voters wanted this, they have the opportunity to vote on. Everybody wants to have an opportunity to participate, but I think when you get confusing or complicated propositions in there and constitutional amendments, then it people are concerned about making a decision on this particular one, especially the one on home equity loans.
Yeah, so Proposition 2, if people mm-hmm. vote for this and it wins, then it will lower the fee cap for getting a home equity loan, but it also takes things out of that would be under that cap. So that it would actually, at the end of the day, make getting that loan more expensive. Also, it also frees up more capital that people have in their homes so they could be able to borrow that and use it for things like education or buying a boat. It's up to them, but there it is. This is something. Who supports this bill, Grace?
I've only found that I believe they're called the Realtors Association that has been putting out mailers about this proposition.
Yeah, the Realtors and the Texas Banking Association. And which one is the constitutional amendment for raffles? Why do we have one for raffles?
Well, we have two for raffles. We don't have just one for raffles. let me look through and find it. If you
I know
find
Prop
it first,
7
let me know.
Is
Prop
for-
7 is... Yes, Prop 7 is a fun one. Who wouldn't want to be in a raffle for
saving money?
For saving money. So you open a savings account, then Savings and Loan can have a raffle, and you could sign up for it and perhaps win something, because that's what a raffle is. The reason why this is a constitutional amendment is because it sort of has to do with gambling, and that's controlled by the Constitution. So some people are concerned about it because it is a type of gambling, and other people are very excited about it because they're, I think, a third of Texans don't have a savings account, and they really would like savings, loans, and banks to encourage people to save money. And so raffles is one way to do that. Why do we have to vote on it? It's just the way our Constitution is created here in Texas.
It just seems like, so they want, in order to get people to save, they say, open up an account, and then you get, what, a ticket or something? What, are you going to get a Powerball?
I don't know. It's a raffle, so it's whatever they're raffling off. I read an article, I think it was by KUT, and it said, open a savings account, get a toaster. But I don't know. I just know people are for it and against it. And it's a decision that the citizens of Texas get to make, whether they would like to encourage to have a law in the Constitution, amendment to the Constitution, that encourages people to have savings accounts.
All right. We're going to take another one-minute break. We're going to continue talking about the propositions that are before Texas voters. We know that these props traditionally have been low enthusiasm for our electorate to come out and support these. And I wonder why that is. Take a guess. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. If you are a fan of any of these propositions or you are wary of them, give us a call. Tell us what you have on your mind. The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Voter turnout for constitutional amendments has been very anemic over the years, but you can check your voter registration status, look at a sample ballot, and find your polling location at the Bexar County Elections Department website. Election is tomorrow. That's Election Day. And we have a link posted on that on our website at tpr.org. We're talking about these propositions before the voters with Scott Braddock from the Quorum Report and the Texas Take podcast. We also have Grace Chamaine. She's a board member of the League of Women Voters here in Texas. And Scott, tell me, why do you think that voters aren't stampeding to the polls to weigh in on these propositions?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. You know, when you make a change to the Texas Constitution, the first requirement is that it has enough support to make it through both the Texas House and Texas Senate, with two-thirds of the members voting yes. And some of these propositions, in fact, one of the ones you were just talking about, Proposition 2, which has to do with the home equity loans, that actually had no opposition in the Texas legislature. No Democrat or Republican voted no on that. And the fact of the matter is that these things are, for the most part, non-controversial. Now, if you think, and of course, there are some exceptions to that. The Prop 2 does have some opposition, as you mentioned, and some concern from some people. But one of the things that jumps to my mind immediately that was sort of a high, or was definitely a high interest change to the Texas Constitution, was when there was an amendment added to make it extra illegal. This was years ago. Make it extra illegal to have a gay marriage in Texas. It was already illegal, and then it was going to be constitutionally illegal as well. Of course, that all changed after the more recent Supreme Court decision. But the fact that something would enjoy that much support in the legislature means probably that people around Texas would generally support whatever that thing is as well. One thing that pops to mind that's the opposite is that if you look at polling in this state, if it was to ever go to a vote of the people, it, according to polls, would be no question that Texans would vote to legalize casino gambling. But that never enjoys anywhere close to two-thirds support in the Texas legislature, so that it sort of stays bottled up in the Capitol building.
So, Grace, you mentioned there was a second proposition for raffles, and that would be Prop 5. That's the charitable sports foundations.
Yes, and if you recall, I don't know if it was 2015 or 13, where the major sports teams that are in the larger cities were able to get a constitutional amendment to so that their charitable foundations could have raffles. And now they would like to amend that amendment that we passed a while back to make it so that more sports teams were able to have this. And it's pretty interesting because these sports teams are all over Texas. These are more minor sports teams, hockey, basketball, football, baseball, and other, you know, even golf teams may have a charitable sports foundation. And they would like to have raffles. And that's and what you brought up earlier is the main arguments against it is gambling. And the arguments for it is that it sort of shares the raffling experience all over Texas.
And that's what people want. People want that experience. And but there's money involved. And whenever there's money involved, things get kind of shaky. Who is in charge of making sure that these charitable sports foundations, especially now that we're going to loosen the definition of a professional sports team, who's going to make sure that these charitable raffles are going to be on the up and up?
That is a very good question.
Yeah, if I could jump in on that, Dave.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of things that the Attorney General would generally take complaints about.
Right. But, you know, we have an organization that looks after bingo, and they try to keep a close eye on what's happening with the bingo, even though that's kind of loosey-goosey at times. But anything like that for these raffles?
Not that I'm aware of. I'd have to go back and look at the legislation. But, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about these different propositions that have to do with games of chance, games of luck. And, of course, the reason that we have to have constitutional amendments on these is because the Texas Constitution specifically has prohibitions on these games of chance or games of luck. What is legal, of course, and is regulated by another body that we haven't mentioned, the Texas Racing Commission, parimutuel betting, that is legal in Texas, so horse racing and dog racing and that sort of thing, although those industries have struggled in this state and have been trying to figure out a way to stay viable.
Let's go to the callers, and there's David on the line. And hi, David. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just had two questions. One for one. I have a question for each proposition, not all seven, but just one, and I think it's six. They're the property tax ones. So I was just curious as to, I get that there's a kind of pathos to the idea of giving a tax break or a tax cut to a certain group based on sacrifices and so on. But my concern is that I didn't see any studies. I went on the Women's League of Voters website, and I'm very grateful to them for providing information because it's one of the few places where I could get information on these propositions. But I couldn't find data as to how are we going to compensate for the loss? Is the loss going to be significant in terms of taxation? Is it going to have an impact on the budget?
All right. So Prop 1 and Prop 6 would provide an exemption from ad valorem taxes for certain individuals. And Grace Chemaine from the League of Women Voters, someone's got to make up that gap. And it's going to be everyone else, I guess.
I think that's my answer is I believe it's going to be everybody. All the other taxpayers have to say that, yes, we are willing to pay these people's property taxes.
Yeah, and, you know, the deal, Dave, is that at the Texas Capitol this year, and this year especially, but in some past sessions as well, Republican lawmakers and Democrats as well, to be fair, have been falling all over themselves to try to find a way to reduce anybody's property taxes. If you talk to people from the Red River to the Rio Grande, people will tell you that their property taxes are too high, but the debate has been about how to fix that, right? You have the Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, who has said that local governments ought to be reined in, that there ought to be a cap on how much that they can increase their property taxes by. And then you have the retiring Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss, who we were talking about earlier, who has argued that if you want to reduce property taxes for everyone, then what you need to do is take a serious look at reforming the way that public schools are paid for in this state. Because when you get your property tax bill and you look at the items there, the lines, the itemized part of it, the largest chunk, about half of your property taxes, is your local ISD. And so Strauss and some other Republicans, along with most Democrats, they've said that, look, if you want to reduce property taxes for people in a meaningful way, we need to do the hard thing, which is for the state to look at the way that it pays for public education, which is constitutionally mandated, by the way. And others have said we could do the easy thing, which is tell local governments that you have to do more with less.
So are we promoting these propositions enough? Are they getting enough publicity? Or is the media falling down on the job? Because people just don't know that these things are being put out there for the election and that they need to go vote tomorrow. And so, Grace Chamaine, with the League of Women Voters, you're doing your part, but do you think that more needs to be done?
I think, yes, I definitely think more needs to be done. We have videos on our website that are very short and easy to watch about each of the proposition, and we have information on our voter's guide. But I also want to say that there should be more information about these. If you want Texans to vote on propositions to the Constitutional Amendment, you need to put out information. We did a review of election websites and found out every county runs their own election, and many of them have an election website, and there's just not as much information, and it's not easily accessible. And I think that is one way the government should help promote these elections.
All right. So Grace Chamaine, board member for the League of Women Voters, we'll let you go. Also, Scott Braddock, editor of the Quorum Report, co-host of the Texas Take podcast. And we're going to shift gears now, and we're going to bring in Paul Flav. He has been following developments with the shooting, the church shooting. And Paul, welcome back.
Thanks, Dave. Hey, appreciate it. Just a quick update. We know not a ton more than we knew before, but that we have listed the number of guns. Joey had given us at the top, four guns, an AR-556 rifle at the church, a 9mm Glock, and a Ruger 22 caliber.
And these are the ones that were in possession by Devin Patrick Kelly.
Devin Patrick Kelly, the shooter, the alleged shooter at yesterday's massacre at First Baptist in Sutherland Springs. Yes, and we know that they're currently investigating if he did this alone. There are still unanswered questions about that in terms of his planning. They know that he acted alone, but they're not sure about planning and other things.
But we don't know anything about the man who engaged Devin Patrick Kelly, the guy who came out with the rifle and began that firefight. And he's being called a hero. He's being celebrated. And yet he is not. He remains unnamed.
We have some information about him. If you will give me one moment, the man that pursued him was named Johnny Langenford, is what?
Right, but he was from Seguin, and he was the guy that drove up. And he's not the guy who lives across the street from the...
They have not released names. There's a lot of unknowns around the story that they have not released names of, including, we have been identifying Devin Patrick Kelly's relationship with congregants as in-laws, but it is still not clear. We have not confirmed that he is still married to... the person he was married to make them in-laws. So it's not clear if those are former or current. It's not clear if he has a wife currently or if he is divorced. There's a lot of unknowns around the case as it continues.
And we have a team of reporters from here, Texas Public Radio, but also across the state who are working this story, and we're going to be able to tell you what happened and talk more about the victims of this tragedy, and we'll have those for you in future newscasts. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.